The Old Time Review Show podcast, brought to you by Southwaves Audio. Now here's your host, Jamie Dyer.
Hello and welcome to the Old Time Review Show podcast. My name's Jamie Dyer. I'm joined by Cynthia, who's going to give us her top five, or certainly five, recommendations from the TV world. Remember, it's all pre-1980 in the most part. And Cynthia, before we start, can you tell us a little bit about your podcast? Because you're a podcaster.
I am a podcaster. Thanks having me on the show, Jamie. It's a great opportunity that a podcaster affords another podcaster a chance to sit in their virtual studio. So thank you for having me. I am the producer and the host of Advanced TV Herstory. It's a podcast dedicated to telling the stories of TV women and the importance of representation. What women see when they see other women on TV is this tremendous boost of confidence and understanding that we can do things, that we can be things, and that we have voice. And the 80s, all of the TV before 1980 is even more powerful because, well, for two reasons. One was there was such limited TV. There were really only three major networks in the United States at that time. And it was just coming up to the women's movement. The ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution, and also something called Title IX, which brought equal opportunity to education. Those were passed in roughly 71 and 72. And so the period from 1970 to 1980 in American TV was explosive for women. And so the shows that I'll talk to you about, well, two of them are from the 60s, but a few of them are from the 70s, and that was a very rich time.
Well, from the list that you've given me, that is certainly going to be the case. What is your first choice in this particular episode?
You know, I have to say that the most influential woman-led TV show is the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which ran from 1970 to 1977. It was a breakthrough for two reasons. One was she was a single working woman, no attachment to any man. There was no man who was her focal point in any more than maybe one or two episodes. And that also, there were more women on the backside of that show than had ever been. There were women writers. There were women managing the wardrobe, women doing the casting. It was very woman-centric on the backside, and that led to its success and its appeal to a very rapidly changing audience of women. You know, the women were soaking it up.
And obviously, compared to her previous role, Mary Tyler Moore, on the Dick Van Dyke Show, it's a complete change, isn't it?
It was a huge change. She really was able to be independent. And the men actually on the backside, as they were creating this series, they wanted her to be married. They kind of wanted her to be divorced, but that was far too controversial. She really managed it to make it very realistic, even though she was actually on the older side at that time in her life than her character was supposed to be. It was fresh. The other great thing about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which is certainly available at least on American DVD, is that it spun off Rowena, Phyllis, and the hour-long drama Lou Grant, which was about newspaper journalism in the later 70s.
Yes, some of those of which have been seen in the United Kingdom, but not nearly enough. Why do you think, I mean, I've watched episodes of this show and they kept building on the success of it, didn't they? They kept adding new characters such as Betty White later on. And it's quite an interesting kind of thing how it, how do you think it kind of builds up over its run?
She becomes, you know, her wardrobe is definitely the face of the 70s. She became much more sophisticated. Her hair was more sophisticated. She, in that character of Mary Richards, she took on more responsibilities. And some of the subject matter got a little bit more serious. It was a little bit more provocative of the times. And then it sort of petered out. You know, she was at that point where either they needed her to definitely rise to something higher because they were running out of storylines, and they were running out of fresh people to bring in and create something new, which often happens with, technically, it was a workplace comedy, which has been replicated time and again you know, across, well, over the decades.
Well, yes, and certainly in my opinion, never bettered either. Still got a massive fan base out there. What is your second choice of program in this episode?
You know, I'm going to go back a bit, and it's partly because I'm about ready to release a 5-episode series. So 3 episodes with on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, in part an interview, a great interview with a woman who really wrote a book that explored the whole backside. So this, I am simply sort of bringing forward a lot of really great research that's been done. There's also a lot of research about the Judy Garland Show, which ran from 1963 to 1964, 26 episodes. Most of that research has been done by men, and it took an opportunity for me to interview a woman who sings Judy Garland songs and does a live show. And we started talking about more of the feminist side, the experience Judy had that she brought to that series and why it failed. And so it's an extraordinary, well preserved, it was shot on film. And so when you're able to see it on YouTube, even, it is just so crisp, and it was so well produced that it truly is a time capsule. And it's such a testament to her talent.
And certainly, as you said to me beforehand, it's a very important kind of variety show. Why do you think it was so important?
It was important for a few reasons. Number one is she was the greatest name to ever, even today, she is the greatest name to have been given a variety show. And it was based on a $23 million per year contract. There was a tremendous budget for production, and so that production value is very high. She had on some really great names. She paved the way for that musical comedy variety show that ultimately Carol Burnett took to a much grander scale and had significant longevity. The hard part with Judy is that they didn't quite hit the right format, and they didn't really work to her strengths. It was also probably the pinnacle of her latter career. If you say her early career was at MGM and all those great Andy Hardy movies, and obviously The Wizard of Oz, her career stumbled there for a while. The 50s, that was a very hard decade for her. But the early 60s was really where she was at a very mature place, and she was healthy and really producing some incredible music.
And of course, during that decade, as you say, very prolific. Lots of her greatest work is done in that decade.
Yes, yes. The shows in London sold out and sold out and sold out. And it sounds like it would have been an incredible thing to have seen. And many people, I'm sure, still recount having been in any of those audiences.
And would you say, I mean, you mentioned Carol Burnett kind of took it to another level. Do you think that her inspiration from that, her kind of the way it was done and that sort of thing, do you think it's carried over into the present day?
I think there were a lot of women who were watching the Judy Garland Show and trying to figure out how they would take her strengths and carry it into their own personal careers. From Carol Burnett and also the Cher show, or the Sonny and Cher show, Bob Mackie, the incredible wardrobe costume designer, you know, gown designer, he got his start dressing Judy. And so that was his opportunity to really get that experience on a weekly show, which then he became a fixture of Carol Burnett and brought her to a much, much more elegant evening gown. And then Cher, every single major Cher costume, whether it was at the Grammys or the Oscars, was a Bob Mackie production. So there was that level of sort of sophistication that we came to expect, at least of our women performers, when they did a variety show. And then you have the musical aspect of it, I think was also a great challenge. Judy did a job of not only bringing on old standards and old favorites, whether it was Mickey Rooney or Ethel Merman, but she also had Barbara Streisand. She had Lena Horne. Lena Horne, who had at one point been blacklisted from Hollywood, and it was basically in a comeback of her own career. So Judy really put it out there that she wanted grade A talent, and that being on a variety show in the United States on TV was a good thing for her career, not a step down from the silver screen, from the movies.
Because, of course, in those days, certainly in the early to mid-60s, the audiences in America, anyway, were huge.
Yes, they were. There was usually only one TV in a household. That was generally ruled by the parents, and there were only three TV stations, you know, three TV networks to watch. So, and there was nothing else to do on a Sunday night. You were either going to watch Bonanza or the Judy Garland Show in 1963.
And I'm sure even to this day, there are some people that would prefer one than the other, but they're both classics in their own right.
They sure are. A real understanding of the time.
Yes, indeed. Cynthia, tell us about your third choice.
My third, you know, I'm just going to do this in the order that I gave it to you, with a little less to say, because I haven't done a show about, I haven't done a podcast episode about Julia, which was a series from 1968 to 1971, starring Diane Carroll, whose career moved to TV after she had been really considered a singer and a dancer. She was very much a musical performer, and had this opportunity, having out of some other films, to star in the named Julia of the half sitcom, making her in the 60s then the first sort of modern black woman to be the star of a sitcom. There actually was an earlier TV show called Beulah, which the star character was Beulah, and she was a black maid or housekeeper. But Julia was a working woman. She was a nurse. She was a single mom. Her husband was lost in the Vietnam War. And so there were some very American overtones. There was some controversy on the backside, and this is why I do want to do an episode about it at some point, because it was felt as though she really didn't represent Black America, and that in 1968 to 1971, the civil rights movement was very much at the front, and there was just some criticism that she wasn't black enough, and that the white people had sort of just made her gave her a white story, and so it didn't do as much as it probably could have to have a higher racial discussion of racism. And so it's an interesting topic that's going to take a lot of research.
Well, I think so. I did see, I watched a PBS documentary a few weeks ago about people of race in American television. And Julia was one that they highlighted quite a lot, because it was quite groundbreaking. As you say, they might have got a little bit confused, but what do you think through modern eyes? Is it as white as they say?
It's pretty, they basically gave her lines and they gave her plots that made it seem very respectable and very logical for a black woman to basically live in a white community and be accepted mostly by the white characters. It was necessary. You know, you don't break the ground and then proceed to be super controversial. I'm sure it was considered controversial, but it was also, Diane Carroll had such grace, and she had class, and she had very light skin, and she carried the water for 3 years. What I will say, if you ever get a chance to see it, and you can see clips on YouTube, is that the writing was really, it was stilted, and the clothing that she wore was very white clothing. So if what they were trying to do was attract black audiences, I think that black audiences probably watched it for the sake that they were at least able to see someone who they could relate to, but it wasn't a full relate to. It was just a sort of relate to.
Which, of course, would in some ways be more kind of seen later on, I suppose, in later series. But, you know, these things have all got to start somewhere, haven't they, really? Because you say it broke some boundaries.
They did, truly. And so I'll just give you my next one, and that was Good Times. So Julia ended in 1971, sort of out a little bit more with a whimper. You know, it didn't move as quickly as the times were moving. And what happened then is when Norman Lear broke into American TV with All in the Family, which spun off so many great shows because it had created very realistic characters. And Norman Lear was bound and determined to use his voice as a progressive white man to look at America and sound like America, and to get into some of those real everyday stories so that Americans could see themselves, not see something that is this higher form of living and entertainment. So the TV series Good Times was the spinoff of Flora Evans, who had been Maude's maid. So Maude was Archie Bunker's, actually Edith Bunker's cousin. So spinoff. Here we have this black family living in the projects. And it was initially, the great story on this is, as much as Diane Carroll was a woman of class and distinction and it was a performer, Esther Roll was too. That's the woman who played Florida Evans. Initially, the writers, the white writers, in Norman Lear's writer's room, wanted Florida Evans to be a single mother of three kids. And she was bound and determined. She wanted to be a model. She wanted to show the positive side of all the hardworking black families that are struggling, that are trying to be good role models for their kids in their communities. Even if it's a poor community, there's still a lot of goodness that comes from a full family. They wanted her to be single. She said, I'm going to do this show unless you give me a husband. And they wanted her badly enough. And there was a lot riding on this that she ultimately, she won them over. But what happened then is that as much as the writers didn't know what to do to have this happily married black couple, because they didn't understand how a happily married black couple could function because they were all white men. And so J.J., that character of J.J. played Jimmy Walker, he was this emerging comedian. He started giving them all sorts of sassy one-liners, the writers. They wrote up J.J. so that ultimately it became a little bit more about this next generation, generational conflict, and the voice of the dad really got minimized. John Amos was very uncomfortable. He finally just said they parted ways. And so the later years of the series struggled. There was not the consistency, and there certainly wasn't the messaging that Esther Roll had hoped. And she was a very accomplished actress who went on to continue to do stage and really, really was an advocate for civil rights and representation in art.
Well, I mean, even from researching this show, Norman Lear even left a little bit later on, didn't he?
Norman Lear sort of hung it up after he had his run and America changed, you know, but by the time the 80s happened and Ronald Reagan and what Americans wanted to watch TV, it was more Dallas and Dynasty and women characters started to get dumbed down in the 80s. You had a few outliers, Murphy Brown and Designing Women, but you had a lot of sitcoms that were just, everybody was trying to push out a sitcom. So Norman Lear backed off. And now he's actually back on Netflix. He has the One Day at a Time. And it is a very fresh look at what was otherwise, again, another really groundbreaking sitcom. This one now has Rita Moreno and just it's a very fresh Cuban American feel. So
yes, it's an amazing thing. I've seen all of them. It is such a great series. And in some ways, I guess these days they're able to not water it down so much. That's the only disappointing thing about Good Times, is that from what I've seen, it kind of turned a little bit cardboard cutout because of catchphrases and such.
Yes, and that's, you know, the beauty of premium channels, you know, paid channels within cable at the time, and now Netflix and all the streaming services, that you can put out content that doesn't have to totally comply with the FCC. That's where Sex and the City, which I realize you limit it to the 80s and before, Sex and the City as an HBO product really was this breakout where they were able to use language and they were able to get into subject matter that was so, would have been so, it never would have made it onto regular network TV. And so it's great Netflix is now there to really push the boundaries of what people want to see and what people want to create. Yeah.
And hopefully as well, put out some of the older material. I'm a great believer in that some of the archive material from both Britain and the US should be seen on these streaming services.
Absolutely. And I think that the future is that. In some cases, the difficulty is just how well the material was preserved. And so the great understanding is that I Love Lucy and how it was even created so that it could be distributed it was Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz's strategic vision to have it preserved at the highest possible level, because the economics of the entertainment industry, they could see there would be the opportunity to reuse it and reuse it. So they made the investment up front. And again, with the Judy Garland, it is on film, and so that's why it's so clear. Bewitched as well. On the other hand, you can watch something that was produced in 2001, and with what we have now for our TV screens, with the high definition, it comes across super fuzzy because nobody anticipated that the clarity would be that. So technology has a little bit more catching up to do on the content end.
Like you say, there are those visionaries there. Do you think sometimes, and this might come across as a bit of an odd question in some way, but do you think sometimes some of the women visionaries are kind of forgotten?
Oh, absolutely. For all sorts of reasons. Not the least of which is the, you know, within entertainment and almost every industry, if a woman is tooting her own horn, trying to actually claim credit for her own work, invariably the politics of the room say that if she gets too bold, she's difficult to work with, because she's starting to push her own ideas. And Judy Garland, you know, bringing some very visionary and a very strong understanding of how to produce a show, both on stage and in film, at many times was considered difficult to work with. Some of the most talented women have been called difficult to work with. And now here we are in, you know, 2019, and we're starting to understand that that's code for something else. And it could be 19 different things that it could be code for. You just don't know. But it's usually coming from a man, not a woman. And it's usually coming with regard to a talented woman. If it's, you know, and it's so there are a lot of women out there, you know, in independent film, documentarians, a lot of storytelling going on right now about who the pioneers were in film as well as in TV. You know, even Betty White, who goes all the way back to radio, she's had four different The Betty White shows, and has sort of reinvented herself through the years as technology and the industry changed. She was able to meet it because she just had really great skills and an understanding of how comedy should be.
Well, yes, and we certainly do love Betty here on the Old Time Review Show. Tell us about your last choice, which, again, is quite an interesting one. It's probably that it's the latest one on the list, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. It would have come sort of a little overlap with Mary Tyler Moore and Good Times. But you can't be a woman in America, or at least my age, without talking about the significance of Charlie's Angels. It was one of the first Aaron Spelling, you know, as we talked about Norman Lear no longer quite having the handle on what America wanted to watch, Aaron Spelling did. And it was a lot of color, and it was a lot of glamour, and it was sort of escapist. And Charlie's Angels was some glamour, a little bit of escapism. It was considered a jiggle show because here were three youngish women. They were, you know, kind of in their 30s even at that point, who were technically former police officers who are now private detectives. And they had agency. They had jobs. They were doing things. They were catching the bad guys. And as a detective show, this was it was the next step from what had been Policewoman. Policewoman, if you ever get a chance to watch it, with Angie Dickinson, who's, you know, part of the Rat Pack, you know, part of the Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin crowd. Pepper Anderson, that character, only sort of caught the bad guy. More often than not, her partner, Earl Holliman, did the physical work. Angie, Pepper would run, and then sort of Earl and the rest of the men would get it. And all too often, Angie Dickinson as Pepper Anderson had to be undercover as a prostitute or as a mother or something, where it just was not, it wasn't as dignified. So fast forward a couple more years, Aaron Spelling says, I want to do this show. And they really, there was not a lot of dialogue there. The backstory of the making of of Charlie's Angels, as told by Barney Rosenzweig, who was behind Cagney and Lacey. The two are very much, you know, cousins. Charlie's Angels, Broken Ground, got some better dialogue because of Kate Jackson and Barney Rosenzweig saying, this has to be more realistic. This is 1976, 1977. Women are expecting to see themselves on TV, and you're not doing them justice. You're not doing your show justice. And so the dialogue got a little bit better. It got a little more sophisticated. The plots are still pretty poor. It's all pretty simplistic when you look at it now. But without Charlie's Angels being there for 5 years, going through more talent than you would like, but some of that talent, you know, they left because they did not see that show evolving the way it needed to. And so Farrah Fawcett wasn't stupid. She knew she had a short period of time to make big money. So Charlie's Angels did a few things right, and it ultimately paved the way for Cagney and Lacey, which was a much smarter, much grittier, much more realistic, bring it down to two women instead of three, show that ultimately captured America for 7 years, 7 or 8 years, and won, you know, Emmy after Emmy after Emmy for both talent and production.
And how do you think Charlie's Angels has really stood up to the test of time? Does it look dated now, or are there still elements of it that have kind of lasted?
You know, I think it gets scoffed at by younger women because they don't understand significance. They don't understand that this was in the middle of the campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment, and that, you know, to see a woman posing as an undercover tennis star or something was actually kind of a cool thing. Women who are in their late 40s, in their 50s, even in their 60s, would probably look at it with a much softer respect, because they understood that before Charlie's Angels, there was even less to watch on TV. So at least they were watching something where they could see a little bit of themselves and know that other people were seeing women who were working and solving crimes and solving puzzles and being smart. Does it stand the test of time? It's a little, the dialogue is kind of poor. The acting is pretty decent.
And made better, of course, as you say, with Cagney and Lacey, which when I saw it written down there, when you sent it to me, that's immediately what I thought, Cagney and Lacey. That's kind of the follow-on to that. So you've definitely echoed my thoughts there.
Yeah. Barney Rosenzweig put in an audio CD into the Cagney and Lacey full series DVD set. So it's this big box, right? And this one extra disc has Barney basically reading a book, reading his memoirs of the making of Cagney and Lacey. And it's remarkable. And I give him and Barbara Avedon and Barbara Corday credit, because it took them about 4 years of working all of the angles to get it actually to a pilot. And then ultimately the struggle to find the perfect Christine Cagney character was originally in the pilot. It was Loretta Swit, but she was still on MASH. And she was caught in that contract. They were not going to let her out of MASH. And then they had hired a woman named Meg Foster. And she was not doing well. The ratings were off. The reviews, the focus groups, nobody really liked her for all sorts of reasons. And Barney Rosenzweig wanted Sharon Glass, who he ultimately married. But she, you know, she had a different look. She had a different sound. And a sense of confidence that neither Loretta Swit nor Meg Foster had. And there was just some great chemistry there. And Tyne Daly had come from the stage and just was a consummate professional, even at that young age.
Now, that you've given your five choices on the Old Time Review Show. And I just wanted to ask you, really, if there was anyone that you could kind of recommend that somebody watch first, which one of those five choices would you choose?
The Mary Tyler Moore Show, I guess, has held up the best. And so you're just going to be truly entertained by the Mary Tyler Moore Show. You are going to watch Julia and just simply see a different America, see how far we've come. But for pure entertainment and just to be in awe, the Judy Garland Show tops that list. It just is so different than anything you've ever seen. And she had such incredible talent, and what a fabulous gift that for 26 episodes, not that you can actually see the full episodes on YouTube, but at least there's a lot there. And it's just extraordinary. It's history. It's herstory.
And it's so great. Nice plug at the end there. That it was so great that all this stuff still exists, because there's so much British history that actually is missing. So it's so great that there's so much American stuff out there. Thank you very much, Cynthia, for coming on today. Could you just tell us again about your podcast and where they can find it?
Sure. Advanced TV Herstory. I've been doing it now for more than 3 years. I have close to 100 episodes out. You can find a lot more about the podcast, talking all about TV women, both behind the scenes and in front of the camera, at tvherstory.com. I am on Instagram at Advanced TV Herstory, on Twitter at TV Herstory, and believe it or not, the Facebook page, it's kind of falling away, but we try to put it out there wherever we can. The podcast itself is available on most every place you can find a podcast, including Pandora and Spotify, and we have a YouTube channel as well. So if the best thing you want to do is just pull up YouTube and press play, you can do it there as well.
Well, I'll certainly be going and checking that out. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Old Time Review Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Find out more about the show at southwavesaudio.co.uk and like our page on Facebook. See you on the next podcast.